Rapids, 1320 AM and W248DE, broadcasting at 97.5 FM.
From the hometown of NASCAR's Dick Trickle, locally grown radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR, 1320 AM, your news talk and sports station.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Liberty Mutual Insurance.
I'm Deborah Rodriguez. There were mostly peaceful protests across the country over the weekend after the Memphis Police Department released body cam video of Tyre Nichols' beating at the hands of five officers during a traffic stop. He died 3 days later. Memphis Church Pastor Gilbert Washington.
We're praying for that young man's family, for his loved ones, for his friends. They're hurting. And we're hurting as well.
CBS's Jared Hill.
A February 17th bond arraignment hearing has been scheduled for the five ex-officers involved, according to Shelby County online court records. Each faces multiple charges, including second-degree murder.
Officials in northwestern Pakistan believe a suicide bomber targeted a mosque in Peshawar today, killing at least 27 worshippers and wounding as many as 147 others. The BBC's Caroline Davies.
A police official told the BBC that part of the mosque's wall collapsed with the force of the blast. Lady Reading Hospital in Peshawar has declared an emergency. They told the BBC that they were still receiving those injured in the explosion. Unverified images on local media show half a wall caved in, the mosque covered in bricks and debris as people clamber over the rubble to escape.
In Cairo today, cameras snapping away as Secretary of State Blinken met with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Blinken says he raised concerns about human rights issues ahead of a meeting in Jerusalem with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to discuss a new surge of Israeli-Palestinian violence. The Chiefs and the Eagles are headed to the Super Bowl.
Racing around the edge, Scott is in! Touchdown, Philadelphia!
Philly crushed the 49ers 31-7 to win the NFC Championship on Fox. Eagles coach Nick Sirianni.
This is something we all dream about, and we get to do it because, you know, we did it better than anybody else in the NFC this year.
The Chiefs beat the Bengals 23-20 to take the AFC Championship, Super Bowl 57, a week from Sunday in Glendale, Arizona. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and President Biden will go head-to-head over the nation's debt ceiling when they meet Wednesday. Republicans insist on budget cuts before they raise the borrowing limit. Speaker McCarthy telling CBS's Face the Nation.
I want to make sure we're protected in our defense spending, but I want to make sure it's effective and efficient. I want to look at every single dollar we're spending, no matter where it's being spent. I want to eliminate waste wherever it is.
The president insists negotiating over raising the debt ceiling could trigger a recession. No school today in Woburn, Massachusetts. Teachers like Eric Scarborough are on strike.
It's unfortunate that we have to do this, but you get to a point where you've been pushed too far.
S&P futures down 35. Dow futures off 205. This is CBS News.
Nobody should have to pay for one-size-fits-all insurance coverage. Liberty Mutual customizes your car and home insurance, so you only pay for what you need. Liberty Mutual Insurance.
Do you know what people see when they Google you? Search engines don't always get it right. And when they're wrong, it's your reputation on the line. So what do you do when you don't agree with your search results? Call Reputation Defender at 800-401-6681. Reputation Defender by Norton is one of the most trusted names in online reputation repair. We have over a decade of experience in fixing people's search results, and we can help you too. Using cutting-edge approaches, Reputation Defender pushes unflattering information down to lower pages of your search results, where few people ever look. We also promote the good stuff so that it rises to the top, letting you put your best foot forward. Your good name is too valuable to leave to the whims of a Google algorithm. You owe it to yourself to take control with Reputation Defender. Visit www.reputationdefender.com or call 800-401-6681 for free advice on your situation. 800-401-6681. That's 800-401-6681.
Light the lamp.
All the way down, he scores! A 200-foot empty net goal for the captain.
And defend the ice.
Driving in, centering pass. Oh, great sliding left pad save.
This is America's college hockey capital.
Fire one towards the net, it scores!
This is your radio home for Wisconsin Badger hockey.
Right here on WFHR, locally grown radio, your home for Wisconsin sports.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here. I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe, and is the best way to protect that legacy. You know what? We should make an emergency communication plan. That way we're ready this year. At my dorm, we have emergency kits for earthquakes and wildfires, but I'm sure there's something more local. I can send you with a link.
Okay.
Smart.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Here's your forecast from locally grown radio WFHR. A wind chill advisory begins at 8 p.m. tonight and continues until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning. Lows level off around 16 below. Tonight, under mainly clear skies, west winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Daytime highs approaching 12. Tomorrow, a blend of clouds and sun. Lows around 3 above. Tomorrow night. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki. Right now, zero.
Stop surfing the dial. You've found the greatest station ever. Locally grown radio 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM.
Walk back then. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but
this is the Paul Revere Show. Craig Mastantuono sitting in for Mark Thompson, guest hosting. And we are broadcasting live from downtown Waukesha, Wisconsin. AM 540, The Shaw, 101.1 FM. Tonight's guest is Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm. Good evening, John. How are you?
Great, Craig. How are you doing?
Good. Good to have you here, and thanks for joining us for,
it's an honor.
For an hour of talking all things criminal justice related. And, you know, it occurs to me when we lined up this guest visit several weeks ago that a lot has happened since then. And I would be remiss if we didn't begin talking about criminal justice with the events over the last week involving Memphis and Tyre Nichols. These types of cases aren't as frequent as the mass shooting incidents that have become all too much the norm these days. But they're not infrequent. And so when another video of a police-citizen encounter that is troubling is revealed nationally or locally that you've been one of the decision makers too many times in that type of case, there's a lot there. So I wonder if we could just get your initial thoughts on what we know so far about the Tyre Nichols tragic death.
The impact on the criminal justice system when you see behavior like this is just devastating. That's the only way you can describe it. And we seem to be locked into this seesaw between our deep desire to live in a safe and predictable society where everybody respects other people's rights and does not hurt them, and then on the flip side, we see behavior that challenges all of that, and it's taking place in the context of a fairly recent national movement. You know, sometimes these things go in waves that sometimes are separated by decades even, but the George Floyd impact is still being felt in the criminal justice system and in society at large. And one of the commitments people have made is to be more transparent. And then you see this type of behavior where nobody can find a justification or a reason for it. It just seems like just unrestrained brutality, and that impacts people's perception of our system.
Yeah, these cases open up doors to so many questions, don't they, for criminal justice professionals. We're both criminal justice professionals. I was in law school during the aftermath of the trial involving the officers in the Rodney King beating incident in L.A. and the riots that ensued following the verdict. I was in my third year of law school at the time, all the way to today. And it seems like some of what you're describing, when you have video of officers just behaving in a way with an apparently defenseless person in a way that's violent and over the top. It just cuts against the grain of the presumptions that we make about police and policing in our society, does it not? I mean, you don't have to be a criminal justice professional to have these questions, but I think, you know, for prosecutors like yourself, for defense attorneys like myself, it just involves so much more in terms of the analytic, and you're trying to figure out how this happens.
That's exactly right. And the commitment that almost every law enforcement agency has made to using things like body camera, you would just make the presumption that that's going to influence the behavior of the officers. But clearly, in case after case, you know, we're now in, you know, 5 years into widespread adoption of body cameras. And now we live in a society that has essentially universal surveillance in so many different ways. And yet you still see behaviors. I also recognize that Memphis, for example, like many cities, including Milwaukee, has been undergoing a surge in violent crime, right? And so this unit that was created to address that problem, number one, don't name a unit like this the Scorpion unit. That would be one word of advice to give any police agency that is going to aggressively police are likely going to end up in being challenged in court at some point in time.
That's good fodder for a questioning attorney like myself.
That's exactly
just
right.
The title being the Scorpion unit is not a good look for the department.
But what it also reflects is just what I was talking about, that seesaw. So I think they had over 300 homicides in 2001, or 2021. So the leadership in the community said, we have to address this problem. And one way we address it is by forming a specialty unit to go after violent offenders and try to suppress the violent crime that's taking place. That's a response that a lot of communities have adopted over the years. And I'm not saying it cannot be effective, but it can't be effective unless it's closely supervised and monitored so that every action that is taken still respects the civil liberties of every citizen that's in that community. And what happens far too often is that is lost sight of. And that's what I see unfolding there is just pure, unrestrained, we're going to do what we want to do, and we don't really care what the rules are. And that's like I said, that's devastating to the reputation and the trust that the community has in police departments and in the criminal justice system as a whole.
John, you mentioned something, the rise in violent crime in cities like Memphis, in cities like Milwaukee. You are the Milwaukee County District Attorney. I want to return to that issue because I think this is a topic that I haven't heard a lot of expansive conversations about. A lot of it tends to be reactive. A lot of it tends to be political. But the conversation, I think, involves a lot. So let's return to that subject. But let me ask you about what you just ended your remarks with. This is the Paul Revere Show. Craig Mastantuono. We're talking with Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm. And I think what you're talking about in some respects is culture versus training. And I also think that's a subject that we don't hit on enough when we're talking about police misconduct. We right away start talking about training methods to prevent future incidents like this. But if you're talking about whether it's Derek Chauvin, you know, and the officers not responding and intervening with the prolonged, you know, violence that was being perpetrated on George Floyd at that time, if you're talking about Rodney King and the officers that engaged in the violence rather than tried to prevent it, or this case where people are questioning whether it's appropriate now in light of it in Memphis to pass legislation requiring officers to intervene in police misconduct, it seems like to me that we're talking about a culture issue as much as we're talking about a training issue.
There's no question about that, Craig. And you know, several agencies, departments around the country have specifically taken that on. I know in Washington State, for example, they train all of their officers in one academy, and they put an extensive amount of training into addressing that cultural issue and driving home the point that police officers are first and foremost guardians. They are not warriors. They're meant to be guardians of not just the public safety, but the public trust, and that much of their work has to be focused on helping and assisting people in really difficult circumstances and addressing the full spectrum of needs that, that people have. That requires maturity, sophistication, and yes, it does require extensive training. You and I both have worked with incredible police officers, and we really, really like seeing great police work. Whether you're a defense attorney or a prosecutor, when you see really good police work, you are just saying, this is the way it should be. And look, like any profession, it takes experience. Young police officers are going to make mistakes, just like young lawyers make mistakes. But if you have a culture in the department that holds people accountable and is committed to transparency and improving, and would never allow a subset of any organization to engage in behaviors like you saw right there, well, then you're capable of doing that. But it takes an enormous amount of effort. And one of the things I'm concerned about right now is I don't know if there are enough, if there's enough commitment, if there are enough people that want to come into the profession to do it the way it really needs to be done. Are there enough resources to adequately bring people in that would allow them to do that full spectrum approach? Or are we just going to, are we kind of defaulting? You kind of see this on the correctional side sometimes right now, where it's just sort of like, we just need bodies at this point in time, and we'll take almost anybody that comes through the door.
You're talking about correctional officers in our carceral settings, jails and prisons.
That's correct. I mean, because it's just not competitive. And so I get concerned about that as well, because when you see incidents like that, what it also does is it makes people that might otherwise be interested in public service start questioning whether, well, I don't know if that profession is for me. And that means that you might be losing some really talented people that would make phenomenal police officers.
Yeah, this is a nuanced discussion, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you don't want to say, well, police are, in many cases, rightfully being called out and challenged and even prosecuted for misconduct, such as what apparently is going to happen in the Nichols matter in Memphis. The officers are being prosecuted for homicide, for murder. And so, therefore, we're, you know, recruitment is down because police can't do what they'd like to do. That's not really the argument, right? And I also think it's a little bit of a red herring to start out with, as you often see our elected political leaders, with the general, you know, most police are good and there's just a few bad apples, because it's not really about that either, right? I mean, you and I both know from our business, good people can do bad things. Bad people are capable of good things. Not all of this is as black and white as, you know, there are good people and bad people, and you just got to find the good ones. And that's why, you know, I prefer to talk about the challenges of the job and what can go wrong during the challenges of that job. And what's the culture within that in which it all occurs? And I think it's much more complex and nuanced. But I do think there's, you know, to me, as I'll tell you, as a justice professional, the first and only, actually, time I watched the full George Floyd incident, what struck me more than Officer Chauvin's actions was the failure of the other officers to interfere and to stop his actions. We've got about 50 seconds before we go to break, so I want to hear your initial thought about that, and then we're going to pick that up when we return.
That is ultimately the biggest challenge that law enforcement says, because that goes to the heart of the cultural issue right there. And that is, when I was an officer, the rule was an officer does not lie, cheat, and the hardest one, or tolerate those who do. That spoke to the integrity of the institution. And we have to have a policing culture that does not tolerate this, because it will kill the trust that the public has.
Greg Mastin, too.
Childhood should be the happiest time of life, but for many children living in poverty with blindness, facial deformities, and other crippling conditions, it's riddled with pain, rejection, shame, and isolation. At Mercy Ships, we're answering the cries of some of the world's most forgotten children and adults through free, life-changing surgeries that turn despair into hope. These once heartbroken boys and girls, and many men and women too, are now restored, accepted, and on their way to a life of opportunity and joy. No one can change the world on their own, but together we can transform it by restoring hope to one person, one child at a time. Volunteers from your community and around the globe are bringing life-changing healing and hope to the forgotten poor. To learn how you too can help change the world, one child at a time, go to mercyships.org today.
When I was younger, I may have did some stupid things, even committed some crimes, but I am not a criminal.
I worked for youth advocate programs, yet I was Tamani's advocate, helping him stay out of jail, stay in the neighborhood, and get a job.
As a little kid, I experienced trauma and I acted out. Made some mistakes, but I'm not a mistake.
As Jalen's YAP advocate, I'm always here for her.
YAP is a community-based alternative to youth incarceration and neighborhood violence. Youth advocate programs. Learn how at yapinc.org.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
When we got back from the Working Class Heroes radio tour, one of the things people asked is, what'd you learn? As you're going through rural America, what'd you find? Found angry people, and angry for cause. But the sad reality is they've been fed decades of outrage candy, and they're angry at the wrong people. They're angry at their neighbors. They're not angry at the very wealthy where they should be. Be sure to tune in live weeknights, 8 to 10 p.m. across the Civic Media Radio Network, and have your voice heard.
From the home of the Cranberry Blossom Festival, your news talk and sports station is Locally Grown Radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR, 1320 AM.
Massive talk from Butler to Windlake. Always streaming at WAUKradio.com.
Show. This is Craig Mastantuono filling in for regular host Mark Thompson, and we are joined by Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm. Welcome back, John.
Glad to be here.
We left off talking about the situation in Memphis and the tragic death of Tyre Nichols and culture in policing versus training or the necessity of both. And we were talking about intervention. So you talked about when you were an Army officer, you not only can are prohibited from misbehavior, but you can't tolerate misbehavior or going against orders or rules of general military order. And that's a big challenge, right?
That's exactly right.
I think you don't need to be a criminal justice professional to know that officers collectively go into harm's way. They do difficult jobs. They rely on each other to a great deal, to a high degree. And, you know, they have, you know, the blue line, right? There is a society, there is a culture. And I think it's hard watching them. I imagine it's very hard to go against either the judgment or the actions of another officer. And it occurred to me during the break when you said, you have to have a culture that doesn't condone misconduct and actually intervenes when somebody is endangered. And to watch other officers watch, dangerous actions towards citizens as a defense attorney, I have to tell you, it's heartbreaking. It's got to be even more so for a prosecutor.
It is. And here's the point that I want to reiterate, and that is we have worked with phenomenal police officers, police detectives, the people that would not stand by and tolerate that. But what they do is they practice, after years and years of experience, they practice the implementation of policing and the exercise of really nuanced Fourth Amendment and Fifth Amendment. And in other words, they have mastered, after working really hard, the art of policing. And that's a great thing to watch. And that is what other officers need to aspire to. What you're seeing when people engage in this type of behavior, that isn't policing. That's just a gang beatdown at that point in time.
It's not very effective, is it?
And it's horribly ineffective, right? I mean, it makes no sense whatsoever, and it just violates every precept that you would have. Of course, they're being exposed to tremendous risks, but everyone's a volunteer, and when you volunteer, you're doing so with a commitment to serve to the standards that, that the community expects you to serve to. And that's how you're paid. You're given, if you do it the right way and you face those risks, you're adequately taken care of throughout your career and after your career. And that's the bargain we make. And so there's just simply no excuse for bad policing. I mean, we have to demand more, and quite frankly, departments themselves have to demand more. Part of this is also an offshoot of trying to get by doing more with less, and trying to make arguments that you can do certain things and you're going to save money and reduce crime at the same time. Sometimes it just doesn't work that way. It's just too complicated.
Yeah, I want to transition a little bit into more local aspect, but before I do that, there are some things that Memphis is being critiqued for right now, I think somewhat positively in certain aspects about procedure, releasing the body cams in full, you know, a very fast decision to discharge the officers, an apparently fairly swift decision to prosecute the officers. The police chief is taking some credit. I saw some reference to her being a police reformer, so to speak. You've been in that hot seat where you have to make a decision whether to file charges or not. Talk about the difficulty of that process and comment on what you're seeing in Memphis in terms of procedure.
I applaud them for the speed with which they moved. I will also say that the evidence there, at least on its face, we always have to reserve the presumption of innocence. That's our obligation. But the evidence looks pretty overwhelming there. And because it was captured on a publicly available recording system. I mean, it was put in place by the Memphis police to provide neighborhood security, and that captured things that were not captured, is my understanding, on the body cameras. There were some active attempts to avoid capturing what was actually on the body cameras itself. So that in and of itself, to me, speaks to why you want to move quickly on a case like this if you have that kind of overwhelming evidence. Oftentimes, that's not, even with body cameras and even with surveillance systems, you're oftentimes dealing with a decision that occurs in a matter of milliseconds, right? And so that oftentimes requires a much more detailed forensic review and examination and bringing outside sources in to evaluate whether or not, under those unique set of circumstances, whether the use of force was appropriate, inappropriate, justified, not justified. And so that sometimes just takes more time. But I think what this is demonstrating is that the idea that people had that the more surveillance, the more transparency you have, the better. I think you're going to see this happening more often, that the decisions are going to come quicker and that it's going to more closely represent what the ordinary citizen experiences if they're accused of a very serious felony offense, for example, or you're going to see arrests made immediately. There's going to be a charging decision made quickly.
One of the things that's always bothered me about kind of popular critique of the criminal justice system is kind of summing it up as a zero-sum game. You have victims versus defendants, you know, being more concessionary or favorable to one, you know, takes away from the other side. And it seems to me that when we have police misconduct allegations, that gets doubled down upon, you know, that we either have to let police do their jobs or not in some of the rhetoric. So I want to hear your initial thoughts. We got about 30 seconds to a break, and then we'll come back to that issue.
What we've experienced, both of us have experienced, is that we hold people accountable for a moment in time, for a distinct moment in time. But our victims and our alleged offenders are often interchangeable. They've all been exposed to trauma, to violence, and what we have to do is try to distinguish, you know, the people that have seriously hurt other people and have to be held accountable and still respect our...
The Shaw 101.
News talk and sports on both sides of the dial from Wisconsin Rapids and beyond. Locally grown radio 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM.
Don't flip a coin and let the odds of heads or tails decide which bank you choose to work with for your home loan. Huddle with the mortgage professionals at Key Savings Bank, 811 East Grand Avenue, Wisconsin Rapids, and the town of Rome. You'll find experienced coaches who will help pull together your game plan. No out-of-bounds advice or pump fake offers. You just get that all-important home field advantage. Key Savings Bank, Equal Housing Lender, member FDIC.
Key Savings Bank.
Last spring, you chose hard-working seed, but did it work as hard as you did? At NK Seeds, we know that all the time, all the effort, comes down to this. All that matters now is yield and how the seed performed on your acre. Because you can't fake performance, and bushels don't lie. Visit nkseeds.com/harvest.
What is dedication?
My biggest fear in the middle of my addiction was that my kids wouldn't have a father. I overdosed on heroin, and I lived. And I started thinking, you know what? This isn't my story. My desire to change had finally outweighed my desire to stay the same. I felt powerless for so much of my life. It's important to me that my kids are empowered and truly believe that if they can think it, they can do it. I definitely had to become a better man to be a better father. For the first time, I finally feel like I'm exactly where I should be, where I want to be.
That's dedication. Visit fatherhood.gov to hear more. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
What's up, y'all? I'm Kelly Clarkson, and as the daughter of a school teacher, I know just how important education is. No matter how old you are or your situation, continuing to learn will enrich your life and help remove barriers you didn't even know were there. So much opportunity, y'all. Whether it's a foreign language, history, or a different way to look at things, take some time each day to learn something new. This message is courtesy of the United States Air Force.
Thursdays at 11:30, we are joined by Dr. Michael McCutcheon, who is a psychologist, a lecturer, and additionally, he's won 10,000 fantasy football leagues and loves to help people make easy, free money. Dr. Mike fixes your life and your lineup.
Listen Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. for As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Pry.
I'm Naheem Hines, professional football player
and proud supporter of the Muscular Dystrophy Association.
My mom was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy when I was 14, and I watched her struggle. But MDA helped her get the best treatments and care, and they also help kids like my buddy Ethan.
My name is Ethan, and I'm 12 years old. Thanks to the Muscular Dystrophy Association and people like you, I have more hope than ever before. From day one, they've treated me like family at my local care center. MDA is the only one that funds over 150 care centers across the U.S. to help provide state-of-the-art care for adults and kids like me.
For over 70 years, MDA has been transforming the lives of people living with muscular dystrophy, ALS, and other related neuromuscular diseases. They fund the research for breakthrough treatments, care, and cures. And MDA provides support to thousands of families like mine and Ethan's in communities like yours. Thanks to MDA, kids and adults can live life to its fullest. Join us and learn more at MDA.org today.
Here's your forecast from locally grown radio WFHR. A wind chill advisory begins at 8 p.m. tonight and continues until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning. Lows level off around 16 below. Tonight, under mainly clear skies, west winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Daytime highs approaching 12. Tomorrow, a blend of clouds and sun. Lows around 3 above tomorrow night. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki. Right now, zero.
Talking about the kind of zero-sum game analysis that, you know, really in popular culture almost relates back to like, the Dirty Harry model, right? That you're chasing down bad people and we have to allow officers to, you know, behave badly in order to even out the playing field on the street. Now, most police officers I talk to, in fact, all of them, don't say such things, at least not out loud. And I think the vast majority of them also don't actually think that. I know prosecutors don't either. But that kind of popular cultural knee-jerk is problematic, is it not?
It is, and it's often reflected in comments I'll get from the public. You know, it's sort of those throwaway lines like, you know, quit slapping people on the wrist and quit plea bargaining.
Sure.
And you know, just falling into those tropes is it's just harmful. Because the reality is that the vast majority of the work that people are doing in the system every day is people trying really hard to maintain the social compact is how I call it. All the participants in this are trying to maintain the social compact and respect people's rights, make sure that people are afforded due process and that their rights are respected, whether they're the defendant or the victim. And so that's our experience disproportionately. So anytime anybody falls into one of those tropes, as I call them, it's harmful because it just reinforces that negative stereotype.
Yeah, you were talking about constitutional policing earlier and whether it's effective to not regard constitutional rules and how effective officers can be, and that it's a long learning process to learn how to be effective as a law enforcement officer within the constitutional limitations on your authority. Your experience and your opinions match my own. I find that the officers that are able to walk through interaction with suspects who are citizens without violating their rights are the most effective at bringing you cases that you can prosecute. Do you agree with that?
Go long, don't go short. I used to say that 1,000 times when I was involved in training on you know, case articulation, Fourth Amendment, advanced investigative techniques, all those things. But I would say it again and again, go long, don't go short. And by that, I simply meant that if you were tempted to cut corners or to take the easy way out, don't do it. Because in the long run, it first of all results in a case being dismissed, bringing dishonor on yourself or worse. And most importantly, the person that may very well be committing really serious offenses is going to walk free. And so you're better off taking the time to build the case, work it. And at some point in time, you might not get what you want, but you might get some level of accountability that you're going to walk away knowing you did everything right. And that's the way the system should work.
Yeah, I actually recall when you were on the line, John, as a gun prosecutor, you having a long view towards investigations and working cases with regard to certain suspects. I think I had people that I represented that you were working with law enforcement on watching for years, actually, until their cases came to light. You're a patient fisherman in that regard. Let's turn the discussion a little bit more locally. People are upset locally and nationally at a rise in violent crime. And that rise in violent crime is real, is it not? It's not just a numbers play, is that correct?
It's real. I just never expected to see these numbers. I mean, I came, and you and I both started in the early 90s, and you may even a little bit before then, but the numbers that the peak number was 163 homicides in the city of Milwaukee, and back then you had probably 50,000 more people in the city itself, and so that would have been 1991. I never, from that moment on, we'd have bad years where sometimes we were up in the 130s, 120s, but we had overwhelmingly seen those numbers go down. Through a whole array of different approaches. Yes, different, much more effective policing techniques, different approaches to working with the community to proactively solve problems, community policing, community prosecution, community partnerships, all of those things I thought played a big role in helping reduce the violent crime.
And homicides were trending downward pre-pandemic year to year, were they not?
They were indeed. In fact, we had some of our lowest years in the last 15 years, we've had numbers that matched what they had in the 1970s and 1980s.
And what about were those numbers?
You know, I think it was in 2008, they were in the 80s. I mean, so it was just substantially lower So for the first time this year, we had 214. And the year before that, it was about 192. And the year before that, it was up in the 180s. So those were 3 years in a row, all that have to be directly attributable to the breakdown in so much of the social intervention system that existed prior to the pandemic itself. So there has always, in my mind, been a very close relationship to that, to the breakdown in the safety net and the acceleration of violent crime in the community.
Yeah, it was a life disruption at a societal level. And I always look at my professional community, if you will, of clientele, people accused of crime, people convicted of crime, people in our courts, in our criminal courts, as a microcosm of larger society. The stories are there, the statistics are there, and my anecdotal experiences there of people being extremely stressed, mental health therapists, psychiatrists, psychologists not being in enough supply. We're facing a crisis of professionals available to tend to the criminal justice system, but our profession's not unlike many, where there's a shortage of experienced workers to make systems function properly. And it seems to me that all of that, goes downward to the street level and to, if for lack of a better term, some of the underbelly of society. And when you get people more stressed that are already in stressful situations, we have more violence.
What I try to point out to people is it's not like everything was perfect in 2019.
No.
But there was enough space for us to be proactive and to do intelligent interventions and work collaboratively on, again, community-based solutions to this. Working really closely with neighborhood-based organizations to understand what they wanted to have done and involve them in the solution. That all broke down. And when you couple that with the very successful national policy to put high-capacity firearms in the hands of every single person that is in this country, you combine that with the trauma that you were just recounting, and what happens is almost 100% predictable, and that is that events that should be resolved but with maybe really short-term confrontation, suddenly bullets are flying.
Fist fights become gunfights.
That's it. That's what's been occurring over the last 3 years, is there's just completely unregulated behavior fueled by high-capacity magazines. We're seeing crime scenes now where there's 60 to 80 rounds discharged at one time. I mean, these are things that we just never saw before.
No, I see it in my own practice as well. It's not just the things that sadly erupt in violent crime. It's also just incidents where people are pulling a gun out and getting charged with disorderly conduct while armed for what they perceive as a threat that used to be kind of a trait of insults or a road rage incident. And I'm seeing, people that, to stereotype a little bit, but that really shouldn't be in the criminal justice system because they have stable family lives and jobs and they're older. And they've taken self-defense courses and taught that they need to respond to a threat with the armed, with the firearm that they've been trained to use. And sometimes as a lawyer, I'm saying, yeah, that wasn't a threat. That was just somebody being disrespectful to you, and answered it with a gun.
We forget that when we successfully implemented some of those strategies that I mentioned that actually helped push down the violent crime rate, Wisconsin had the strictest concealed carry law in the country at the time. And we took advantage of that. In other words, we trained extensively, again, in the appropriate use of the Fourth Amendment and the statutes and the laws of the state of Wisconsin to help identify the people that were engaged in violent behavior, but hold them accountable in a legal, constitutional way that would survive challenges from great attorneys like yourself. And that's become extraordinarily difficult to do now that we're such a permissive carry state, and there's even some talk of doing away with the permitting system that we do have.
And just going to anybody can carry.
Constitutional carry. Anybody can carry, right, unless you're prohibited. But how do you know that as a police officer at that point in time? So any kind of proactive identification and stopping somebody from committing an offense with a firearm beforehand kind of goes out the window.
Let's talk a little bit about how politics involves itself in the business that we're in, which is basically criminal justice. It's frustrating to me to see how issues get politicized. The one that we were just talking about, the rise in violent crime, if you listen to some on the far right and on just the mainstream right, it's because of defund the police and it's because of elimination of cash bond. Neither phenomenon which has occurred in Milwaukee or in Wisconsin. We haven't defunded our police, unless you're talking about the lack of shared revenue increasing enough
for
cities.
Well, that's exactly right. That actually has defunded police across the entire state, is the lack of equitable sharing of the funds that local communities send to the state. Had you kept pace over the years with you know, just a reasonable return on that investment, you would not be, you know, for example, I always point out that when I was first elected in 2006, I think there were 1,965, I always remember the number, actual sworn police officers in the Milwaukee Police Department. They're about 300 short of that now. And that's the equivalent of an entire police district station. And so that's because... because the revenues just haven't kept match. In the meantime, the city has actually sent more money to the state than it did 15, 20 years ago. It just doesn't make sense.
So you squeeze the funding. You have a rise in mental health crisis collectively. You have a proliferation of guns. The job gets a lot harder for a lot of reasons of being a law enforcement officer or a prosecutor, for that matter, or a defense attorney. But the funding remains frozen. And then you've got people... you know, throwing bombs at the city, politically, that is, saying, oh, you people are defunding your police when we've squeezed the city dry in terms of shared revenue. It makes no sense to me.
It doesn't. It just simply doesn't make any sense. And then the second issue you raised was actually accusing us of arguing for releasing all criminals without any kind of consequence. And that's always been wrapped into the cash bail argument. And let me make it perfectly clear that I have always, always asked and argued for the ability to rationally argue what the risk was involved in an individual who's been alleged to have committed a crime. And you and I both know that we get frustrated talking around the issue of risk, right? Because the law is the law. The law says that the primary purpose of bail is to ensure the person returns for their court date. That's the primary reason. But for as long as I've been a prosecutor, we've talked around that issue and we've used cash as the proxy. All I've ever said about cash is I've never said I want to get rid of cash completely if there's no other alternative, right? What I've wanted is a rational preventative detention statute, which would say that somebody accused of a really serious crime with substantive evidence against them probably should not be out in bail at all. Other people, you should have the ability to safely monitor in the community, and that requires additional resources and monitoring systems and things like that. That's all we've never said that people should not have cash bail, because we've always recognized that there's risk. But the cash bail is just a lousy way of assessing risk.
And yet somehow when you discuss even the prospect of eliminating cash bail for certain types of cases, it becomes seen as some type of soft on crime issue. Cash and availability of is actually random to the issue of risk, right?
I mean, totally. I remember I was prosecuting a violent drug dealer who was from Jamaica, and he was ready to post $1 million, without any with a cash bond.
Had nothing to do with danger to the community.
Absolutely,
right? It's not lost on me that we're talking about the bail system as we are broadcasting from Waukesha. We are here with John Chisholm, Milwaukee County District Attorney, on the Paul Revere Show. Craig Mastantuono, guest hosting for Mark Thompson. We'll be back after another quick break, and let's pick up that conversation about our bail system.
Lights, camera, action. It is time for your close-up with WFHR's Star of the Day featuring Culver's. Listen to WFHR every Friday morning at 8:30. We'll play a quote from a famous movie, name the actor, character, or movie, and you'll win two value baskets and two concrete mixers from the superstars at Culver's in Wisconsin Rapids. Join us Fridays to be WFHR's Star of the Day featuring Culver's.
We all make promises, big and small, tested over time and distance, tried by circumstances and decisions.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
I do solemnly swear to bear true faith and allegiance.
To help you when you're in need.
To tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
To be considerate and caring. Courageous and strong.
For better.
For worse.
In sickness and in health.
To love and cherish.
To be your loving, faithful friend.
Partner.
Child.
Parent.
Neighbor.
One of our most important commitments is to support our nation's veterans. Learn how you can help a veteran going through a difficult time by visiting maketheconnection.net.
Cancer can feel like something we can't do anything about, but you can. There are screening tests that can catch cancer early when it may be easier to treat. Begin cervical screening at age 25. At 45, start colorectal and breast screening. At 50, discuss lung screening with a doctor. Find resources for free and low-cost screening at cancer.org/get screened. This is a public service message from the American Cancer Society.
Your place for this area's news, talk, and sports. We are Locally Grown Radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR, 1320 AM.
It's for News Talk Radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
This is the Paul Revere Show. This is Craig Mastantuno filling in for regular host Mark Thompson on the Shaw AM 540, 101.1 FM. And our guest tonight is Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm, who is joining us at our Waukesha studio. John, we were talking about a bail system here in Wisconsin, the bail system that we use. There is going to be a constitutional amendment proposed, and it's up for a second vote by the electorate in the April 2023 election, which you and I were talking during the break. It seems like a small or kind of underwhelming attempt to interact with changes to the bail system. Now, what you were talking about before the break on air was a system that assesses risk, holds the most dangerous people in custody without a bond. No amount of cash can post. The Jamaican drug dealer that you were talking about earlier, somebody with $1 million, if they're deemed to be a risk to public safety, there's no bond that can be posted. And the rest of the people, which is what's going to happen in any system, the majority of people that are accused of a crime, whether that's, let's remind our listeners, that can range from criminal operating without a license or after revocation of a driver's license to drunk driving to retail theft or shoplifting to a variety of other crimes that I think most people would say, well, that's not dangerous. Nobody should be, I don't want to pay for somebody to be held in jail for 2 months while that case remains pending. They would be released without a bond. And that's kind of the hybrid model that does, yes, eliminate cash bail for the large majority of people that we can't afford to hold. And I think that there probably isn't a public desire to hold these folks. Is that envision a change that would more appropriately reflect something that you would want to see?
It is. And I've always argued that what we want to take is the population that currently comes into the system, and we want to sift and sort them appropriately. And the people that are coming in because they have mental illness issues or they have drug addiction issues, they've got trauma issues, we want, but they have not hurt anybody else. They have not posed a significant risk to the community. We want to do something with them so that they don't keep coming back again and again. So that is the premise behind, I often get accused of, they use that quote saying that, you know, of that population, is there a chance that one of them might, in fact, go out and commit a homicide?
You'd have to say yes to that.
You'd have to say yes to that, but it had nothing to do with me being casual about it. I was simply saying that population, by definition, is a population we want to do something different with so that we could focus on the individuals that were, in fact, harming the community and causing, you know, serious, serious problems, you know, through violent organized activity, you know, the really serious, the sexual offenders, the reckless drivers, all of the people that posed a really significant risk. We wanted to make sure that the criminal justice system had was fully resourced to address those individuals, but then was was diverting out the people that were using up the same jail bed space, the same courtroom time, but were probably better suited for mental health interventions and treatment and alternatives that would actually make them healthy and let them get back to their families and help them. So that was always the premise behind it. So I'm hopeful that going towards this approach will strengthen that movement. That it isn't just a Milwaukee County movement right now. That's strongly supported here in Waukesha. It's strongly supported in counties. But we did take the lead on that early on, you know, with your support and with the defense bar's support, just basically saying, can't we just be more rational about this approach to how we deal with violent offenders?
You're talking about in the years prior to the pandemic.
That's right.
Yeah, with the innovation of public safety assessments and PSAs rather than just a kind of a knee-jerk on setting bond.
That's right.
A couple of quick subjects. We're talking with Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm. Within that, you talked about intervention. You know, most people don't know because it doesn't make the news, and this isn't the part of my work that involves a big trial, nor yours. But when you talk about people that need mental health treatment, it's a regular part of our system that hundreds and hundreds of defendants across the state are getting that treatment while a case remains pending, right? And you know, it's a hard part of my job if I can't get somebody the help they need because they're stuck in jail on a $250 bond and they're indigent.
We have safely diverted tens of thousands of people over the last 15 years and directed them towards those under-resourced but still vital components of our community, you know, that have provided people the help that they need. And in the meantime, we've also, as part of it, we've made victims whole. Again, we're talking about millions of dollars of early repayment of restitution. That happens right away. It's right up front. And that's sometimes all the victims really want. They you know, if you do the restorative circles and things like that, oftentimes what the victims are saying is that, look, I don't hate the person who did this, but I want to be made whole. That's all I want. I don't want them in my life anymore. Thank you very much. I don't want them breaking into my car. I don't want them, you know, but I do want to be made whole. And if you can do that up front instead of waiting 9 months, 12 months, you know, 2 years, that often if you just put somebody on probation, for example, and turn it over to the DOC, it could be years before you see your first restitution.
Sure. And judges are receiving, you know, letters and joined by prosecutors saying, you know, this is the mental health treatment effort this person has made. This is the restitution they've paid during the 3, 4, 5 months that this case has remained pending. That's how we work our cases, isn't it? Prosecutors and defenders is exchanging that information and saying, look, this isn't really a whodunit. It's a what to do about it. And let's get started early. And, you know, I think the, you know, lock them up, lock them all up. You know, if you're accused, that's enough. Sounds, you know, knee-jerk, you know, palatable, but it's not really going to work in our system.
Doesn't work and you can't afford it.
We got about 2 minutes left, and we were talking a little bit about the politicization of the criminal justice system. It seems like every time there's an election, all of a sudden, you know, the public learns about either a dangerous person or a criminal justice tragedy. You and I would be the first to admit there's tragedies in our business, and they don't just involve people being victimized of crime. They often involve people, you know, falling into criminal behavior because of a lack of good circumstances on their part. But it occurs to me that the reason we only see these in April and fall elections is because people are chasing different goals than really making us safer. And I wonder if you can comment on that and whether it's helping our system to learn about criminal cases in that crucible.
It is not. I mean, the reality is that fear-based messaging is effective. It also is a precursor of really bad policy, and it's the policy that costs you tens of billions of dollars and doesn't achieve the goal that you want it to achieve, which is creating a safe and healthy and creating the conditions for prosperity. And if all you do is take a reactive approach to everything and take this short-term hit, and then never go to the heart of the matter and try to address the long-term problems, then you keep getting the same results.
And yet the public does have an appetite for education on these issues. Don't you find that? I find that when a book signing or a public forum or people ask you to speak and they're waiting in line to ask you questions, right?
There's a lot of wisdom out there. It just needs to be heard.
John Chisholm, Milwaukee County District Attorney. It's been a pleasure hosting an hour with you on this discussion. Let's come back and do it again sometime.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Craig Matt.
Over the past few years, the COVID-19 pandemic has affected how we live our daily lives. Today, we also face a mental health pandemic that threatens our well-being as we attempt to rebuild our social networks and communities.
The pandemic has reminded us to value family, community, and our human connections. However, it has also left many of us feeling more isolated, confused, and alone, struggling to find meaning amid loss and uncertainty.
Today, one in five Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges. But many of us do not understand what we are facing or know how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we understand what you are going through, and we are here to help. Our vision is to build a mentally healthy nation for all. We work every day to eliminate stigma, combat mental illness and substance use disorders, and advance mental health. If you or someone you love needs help, you are not alone. Please visit mentallyhealthynation.org.
WFHR, Wisconsin Rapids, 1320 AM and W248DE, broadcasting at 97.5 FM.